PR is a long game if you've ever done it. And, you know, if your strategy is to pitch a reporter cold, you know, find their email and ping them and get coverage tomorrow, you're setting yourself up to be ignored.
Right.
You know, it doesn't start with a press release. I mean, though you have to try to craft something that is, you know, compelling, but it's really your reputation over time. And that takes a long time to build.
Hello, and welcome to the Misadventures in Marketing podcast, presented by the American Marketing Association San Francisco chapter. I'm Steve Haney, a fractional go-to-market executive in Silicon Valley.
And I'm Peter Farrago, a marketing executive in the Bay Area. Each week, Steve and I come together to talk about all things in high-tech marketing.
We share our own experiences running marketing teams with a special focus on technology startups, our successes, our failures, what worked and what didn't. We also invite our CMO friends and other marketing executives onto the show every once in a while, and we certainly hope we're able to impart some wisdom along the way. Peter, how are things in your world? What's going on?
Things are good. Let's see, we're in the holiday season or getting into it, and I'm at a B2B SaaS AI company, so we're pushing hard to try to get those last few deals closed before the holiday break. But it's fun to be part of, I have to say. I don't know how much listeners follow my life, but I took a couple years off between my last job and then decided to get back into startups. And, you know, I'm enjoying the cortisol a lot more this time around, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Well, same here. You know, things are moving along. Interesting, you know, client prospecting going into the holidays. Things are actually accelerating a little bit, which is fun. And so probably going to be a bit busier in the new year than I've traditionally been. And of course, as you said, going into the holidays, all the family stuff and yada yada. It's very busy. And, you know, I've got one kid going into college next year, and there is a whole ritual around art and design colleges that is new to us. So we're learning a lot about that whole new world. It's not like applying to regular college. All right, Peter, moving into our first segment, tech news bits of the week. This is kind of old news, but I did want to mention the latest Canva product launch. I think it was a couple of weeks ago now. And they also had acquired Affinity. And they made that very, very, very good tool free and integrated all the different apps into one app. And I just got to say, it's worth any marketer's time to go view that. I don't know whether to call it a keynote. It was a production. It was over the top. Never seen anything like it. I guess people over in Perth, this is how they get down and party. It was wild to me and exciting. You know, the founders are young. They're still under 40. And the whole vibe throughout this massive, massive hall of people, which consisted of, you know, employees and partners, it was amazing. It's like nothing I've ever seen a U.S. company do. It was vibrant. It was full of energy. And it really makes you want to give these people your money because, you know, product's excellent. They're expanding their portfolio. They keep adding capabilities. They did announce some AI stuff, of course, which was pretty okay. You know, I've been playing with it. It's all right. I can't say anything I've been using Canva for. The AI capabilities blew my mind, but it was very cool. And, you know, we're going to be talking about PR here in a second. And I think that, you know, this loops very nicely into that. How about you?
Yeah, I think big news is a lot of investment in the underlying technology that supports AI growth, and that's really around chips and infrastructure. We heard that NVIDIA is announcing $50 billion investment, and you know, it just goes to show how much you need in terms of computing power, you know, to keep giving customers this type of experience. You know, NVIDIA is, a week ago, NVIDIA had news about this, and you know, they're taking a $5 billion stake in Intel, for example. So there's just a lot. There's a lot going on in terms of the vertical integration, I'd say, or at least the underlying infrastructure. So if you're a person who invests a little bit, you know, I would take a look at, you know, the NVIDIAs of the world and some of these companies, because I think that my personal opinion, not a professional opinion, is there will continue to be a demand for AI, which means there'll be lots of demand for the computing power underneath.
Yeah, but you do know that SoftBank completely sold their stake, right, in NVIDIA. They completely got out, which is freaking some people out right now. So, yeah. You know, I think there will be corrections along the way, but the build out is pretty crazy right now in the investment. How we AI, as the kids say. You know, I've been using these voice interfaces more and just talking to these AIs myself. And, you know, I know you're deep into ChatGPT. I'm deep into Gemini. But, you know, the Microsoft Copilot bot, it has the best voice interface, in my opinion. I've been trying them all, talking to them all. And listen, ChatGPT is fantastic as well. But what I do is, and you talked about this on the last episode, how you'll use it as a partner to help you solve a problem and everything. And, you know, I'll just do general, you know, discussions about larger issues. And, you know, it's okay. I take it with a grain of salt. I'd rather have Peter Farrago there with me on that walk when I'm brainstorming about what do I do about this issue, or, you know, how do I address this problem that I'm faced with. But these bots are pretty interesting. And certainly the fact that they've got this kind of like giant brain that can access all known human knowledge on the internet kind of gives them an edge. But, you know, I just, you know, again, going back to about building trust, I'm not sure I'm quite there with it, but it's an interesting experience. And I know Satya Nadella, he talks about doing this like every day, which I kind of find fascinating. Getting back to Canva, the CEO, Melanie Perkins, on an interview last week said she does that as well. She has a different approach. She'll record it and then do the transcript of her walk where she's brainstorming, and she'll dump that into, you know, whatever AI she uses. I don't know what her preferred bot is. And, you know, have it help her knock around ideas. So anyway, that's me. What about you this week, Peter? What is your AI tool tip?
The tip that I'm looking forward to seeing, if it's possible or true, is that OpenAI announced, or Sam Altman got on Twitter and said, "Hey, we fixed the M-dash problem." So for anyone who's done a lot of writing, especially with ChatGPT, it loves M-dashes, you know, kind of a longer hyphen, which is a good grammatical, you know, punctuation tool. It's great to append like a little idea in the back of a sentence, and, you know, better than using a semicolon. But it's very M-dash happy. This is something I noticed, you know, almost a year ago. Like, gosh, you know, ChatGPT just loves to sprinkle M-dashes everywhere. And it became a telltale sign of AI written stuff.
Huh.
And so people were like, I mean, I was like, you know, everyone's gonna kind of feel like this is AI written if it has too many M dashes. So then, you know, you go through and you remove it, or you ask ChatGPT. This is the frustrating part. You tell ChatGPT, which has a memory, it stores like certain requests you make of it, or key details in a memory. There's a kind of a memory list that you can even edit. But if you told it to stop using M dashes, it would not. And so the only time I've ever sworn at ChatGPT was around M dashes, because it's just like, stop using these effing M dashes. Like,
so you're saying our long national nightmare is over?
Possibly, possibly. So it's my tip is to check it out. Be cautiously optimistic.
This week, kind of interesting. You and I have talked a lot about this topic offline the past week or so. Really about PR and how to best employ PR in the current environment we're in, especially with a lot of AI generated content out there. And you know, kind of like the template boilerplate stuff that's just flooding the zone. However, we eventually kind of came around connecting it to last week's episode, which was how useful is PR actually? So, you know, we kind of had this script laid out, and it's not that, of course, medium to large size companies, certainly, you know, PR firms do a great job and you want to employ them to help get the word out there. But the question really is, you know, how effective is it anymore? Not that this is a new story. You know, I mean, I know certainly smaller tech companies I've worked at, you know, I may have one PR contractor I've brought aboard, just one resource. I probably only get like 20 to 30% of their time, but it's more than enough to work a press release, right? Because you don't just put a press release out there. Nobody looks at news wires anymore. It's really about that PR person and their very powerful Rolodex and going out and emailing the PR to the people that they have relationships with. And, you know, following up with them saying, hey, you know, let me pitch you, you know, let's talk about this. And definitely trying to get in with those larger publications that have the big audiences and whatnot. And so I think what you and I came to, Peter, was that it's just really questionable, you know, even for larger companies, as to what kind of resources you want to put towards PR and how you can best employ them.
Yeah. I mean, PR is effective, when you can get it to work. And I'm torn, you know, because I'm at a very early stage company that has a hard time getting PR, and the resource intensiveness of it, the way you described, is a deterrent because, you know, PR is a long game if you've ever done it. And, you know, if your strategy is to pitch a reporter cold, you know, find their email and ping them and get coverage tomorrow, you're setting yourself up to be ignored.
Right.
You know, it doesn't start with a press release. I mean, though you have to try to craft something that is, you know, compelling, but it's really your reputation over time, and that takes a long time to build.
Yeah. So, well, and I guess this is in the context of the thing we didn't mention, was that you've got your social media channels, you've got hopefully your key followers and influencers and journalists following you, although that's a whole nother big effort, and that you're just able, you know, to get your announcements out there. I think increasingly it has to be video as well on TikTok and Reels and all the other ones, not just a, you know, a blog post announcing a compelling story. And, you know, that's kind of the alternative. I mean, that's what's kind of outweighing, do you need this, you know, whole other entity or a whole other function within your company, going out and trying to get these other folks to amplify your voice. And like I said, I don't think this is a new discussion or a new phenomenon. It's just, it's becoming more and more acute, I think, as, you know, social takes over, as these other forms of media start inserting themselves into, you know, the social media fabric. And, but, you know, I think it just comes down to, do you have a compelling story, right? I think the days of, we've got this product and it's new and we're going to put it out there and everybody's going to love it. I think it's more of an ongoing narrative about the company and its products. And it's kind of like agile software development. You know, before in the old days, every 3 years, there'd be a major release of a product and there'd be a big marketing effort leading up to it. Then you'd have the big product announcement. And then agile development came along, and certainly web development, and then the app stores. And every time you have a new feature, you know, it's a small one, you just drop it in. So it's this drip, 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 drip of innovation. And, you know, you may have these crescendos, you know, again, like the Canva announcement a couple of weeks ago, where you have these big things. Apple is still in this mode, right? Every year they have their operating system upgrades and their hardware upgrades, and they have these events, you know, maybe three or four major events a year, and they're still in that rhythm. But I think for a lot of companies, particularly if you're in B&B and you're not some broad, sexy consumer tech company, you know, it's more of a consistent drumbeat. And I think that gets back to when you're doing PR, you have to have this story. It's like your television series always running, right? And there's a new episode every week in the story of XYZ Acme Corp. And, you know, you're just consistently putting out this drumbeat of news and features. And then maybe you do have a big gigantic release where something happens, but it gets back to what's your story, what's your company about, and kind of keeping those major press outlets hopefully in the loop as they're following you and you're announcing, you know, these small wins along the way, so that when you do have the bigger thing that you're trying to draw attention to, it's all part of that rhythm and that dance. And there's a story there to tell. You know, who's your company? What problem are you solving? You know, what are the plot points that prospects want to pay attention to, so that you can, you know, get them into the fold and bring them along?
I have been in the tech press game for, you know, 20-ish years, and there are far fewer reporters and outlets now, period. There's more fragmentation. There's a lot of, you know, like The Verge, you know, Casey Newton is the editor-in-chief, and he has his own Substack called Platformer now, right? Mm-hmm. And Mike Isaac and Jessica Lessen left the New York Times, and they have The Information. So also subscription Substack based. All Things D was, you know, Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg. Mm-hmm. And they had splintered off from, I want to say it was the Journal or the Times. I can't remember which at this moment, but that outlet is now gone, and so on. TechCrunch is particularly hard to reach right now. I know the folks at VentureBeat, and they've really shifted their focus to be very specifically about technology for enterprise, AI for enterprise. So they're mm-hmm. very focused on a specific audience now. So one, how you reach an audience has changed. Yes, social is the way. Companies can reach an audience through social, especially B2B on LinkedIn. And, you know, press or news outlets have been posting to social for a long time. You know, in the days of Facebook, where there was a lot of news, I was at Yahoo, where we had TechCrunch was under my portfolio, actually. And, you know, we were getting a lot of news traffic, if you will, or exposure through social networks. And there was a question of, like, well, we don't own that channel. Do we count that? What's the deal? So news outlets, whatever's left, and companies are just going directly to social. So things have shifted. As far as like the motion of PR, what you were talking about, I disagree with, like, which was, you know, plot points and this and that. And that's the whole problem, right? Is that that's not newsworthy. That, in my opinion, will flop because it's not PR. It's a press release and nobody cares about your company's promotion and progress and boilerplate, unless you're significant and you maybe raise money, or, you know, there's a big financial transaction, like you were sold or something, or you're big enough already and you've sort of, you're above a certain threshold where there's a beat reporter on you. And that's very few companies. So I don't know. I think that there's a stat out there and I double checked this. If you pitch a reporter, that means email them, is most likely the way you do it. You email Sarah Perez at TechCrunch, or Anthony Ha at TechCrunch, or whatever, Matt over at VentureBeat or whatever, Matt Marshall. You know, on average, you're going to get 3 out of 100 emails getting a response. And that could include no thanks. That can include, not my story. So of the pitches you send out, 3% are even to get a reply. And that's probably if you're a bit of a known entity. So this has been my experience my whole career with PR, is that you very rarely get replies. And when you do, this is sort of ironic in some way, it's usually all lowercase, 7 or 8 words, no punctuation, which is kind of funny because these people are writers for a living, but they don't have time. They're email bankrupt, which means their inbox is overblown. There's a lot of people pitching them. So my point is, you just can't get attention. You have to be newsworthy and don't expect a response, and certainly not after one or two pitches. Yeah, what I'll say too is, as a head of marketing, the first thing I start talking about, if we do start talking about press, is newsworthiness. What is newsworthy? And that's like just vocabulary or concept I introduce into it. Because if you talk to any good PR agency, that's what they're going to talk about. Like, you're going to go through a very intensive process to think about positioning and all the things you might be able to do to kind of be credible and newsworthy. And they're going to talk about newsworthiness a lot because the stakes or the odds are so stacked against you, and the bar to be interesting is so high.
I guess the point I was trying to make is that it's kind of like the branding thing. I mean, you know, you just want to be top of mind when the newsworthy thing does come along. And it's not just, again, a cold call of, oh, we're going to say something now, right? It's like a logical part of what your company's been doing and what they've been hearing about your company over the past few months or something.
If you're looking at PR as a ongoing activity that you can staff or even have an agency, some of the things you can do to hopefully increase your coverage is, you know, the term is proactive pitching, but basically you need to pitch how your news fits into a bigger trend. You know, so you're pitching a trend piece. So what you're doing is you're coming, and this is not new. Good publicists have been doing this a long time, is they understand kind of what's going on with news, and they are basically trying to help reporters with, you know, framing what would be a compelling story for that reporter's audience.
Yep.
And then through that, you know, hopefully you might have your CEO gets a quote in paragraph 6 or something because your company is associated with it. So like an example is Propense AI. Didn't pitch their AI tool. They pitched how AI is reshaping legal services, right? And, you know, that way you're part of a bigger trend, and you don't try to have it all about you. The other obvious tip, and this is true of almost anything, is shorter pitches. You know, you can probably get a 6% response rate based on the data for pitches that are 150 words or fewer. If you do that pitch a bit longer, you're going to drop down to like 1.5%. So you can increase the chance by like 4x just by having a short, crisp pitch.
Yeah.
So these are a couple things. I think the third one I'll say is data stories. You know, you need to share a perspective based on data. Like, you have to offer a new insight. And that usually has to be based on primary data and proprietary data. So like data that you might have gotten through a survey about, I don't know, attitudes of marketers, you know, if you have a pretty good survey, attitudes of marketers using AI or something, it's like X percent now say they're using this or that. And it has to hopefully be like a, you know, you're breaking a story, as it were. So, you know, but, you know, like, I want to go back to something you mentioned, is that you put your PR people on it. And I think that PR is very valuable for building brand credibility. And it's also great for SEO, because you get, most of the time, you get a backlink from the article back to your site. And that's worth a lot, because it increases your domain authority, because all these press outlets have like 90 plus, you know, out of 100 domain authority. And that's actually extremely valuable. But in order to brace yourself for the work involved, you've got to realize you've got to be doing a lot of outreach. You've got to be offering, you know, a lot of proactive pitching. You've got to be providing data stories. They may not be picked up, and you just kind of have to, and there's a lot of faith, because you're not getting a lot of feedback from the reporter, because remember, only 3% of the pitches get a response even, and they're terse. And so you have to, again, view it as a long game, and it can feel quite expensive, and it can feel like it's not yielding results. At the same time, you know, the later you start, the longer it might take, unless you can kick off with a big event, big announcement.
I just think back when I was, you know, head of marketing for a well-established software company that was global. And, you know, we were following the, you know, twice a year product launch schedule, which was new for the company because they had been doing it once, you know, once a year. You know, it was very global. Company had been around a long time, users all over the planet in multiple languages. And so we really had this very large effort to get the word out there. And then we had our distributor partners all over the globe, and these were very large entities, and they had their PR functions, and, you know, they would be on our behalf going out to their local outlets and, you know, getting the word out. And so this was a, you know, this kind of stuff was just straight, very forward, straight software product PR to get attention, to drive sales. This all worked quite well. Now, that being said, I'll say this. We had a whole nother line of products where slow growth, added features every 1 to 2 years, and we just chose not to put any PR behind those products. And we did just go to the socials, because anybody who mattered in this, you know, niche product category, they were following us on all the social media channels. And sure, we'd do a press release, wouldn't do any active outreach to any kind of press outlets. And, you know, that's what was adequate for those products, because they were kind of fully baked, right? There wasn't a lot of innovation in the space, a lot of substitutes, and, you know, we could get away with that. But, you know, that was definitely not what we're talking about now, where we're talking about very hot product categories, accelerated. I mean, just, you know, we didn't have people with their faces in their phones back then the way we do now. And just the, again, the acceleration and the flooding of the zone of just our attention and everything else. It's a very different dynamic. So, you know, you were talking about looking at the trends and the waves, and, you know, there's also the opportunistic PR efforts, right? Where if something in your category is trending, you know, you want to get out there and you want to make relevant blog posts, and, you know, maybe you do a press release around, you know, if a certain company gets funded in a similar category to yours, then you want to go out and start talking about, you know, what you're doing to kind of catch that whole wave out there on the interwebs. And that's very opportunistic. And, you know, you can go out and pitch something because it's a hot topic. Again, I'm not talking anything, you know, revolutionary here. You know, we've all done this in the past under these old models. But, you know, it takes on a different relevance, I think, in this new world where it's so hard to get noticed. Just get in front of the parade, right? Because the parade's happening. Just start marching in front of it with your baton and, you know, try to get some attention that way.
Yeah, it's called newsjacking. You can try to hop onto a trend. But, I mean, again, this presupposes that you have an ongoing PR effort, right? Because in order to be like, you know, have sort of fast follow or newsjacking style, you know, it just means you have to have someone staffed on it, right? Mm-hmm. Going after it. And if you can reach everybody, like you gave just now two scenarios, if you can reach everybody through, let's say, LinkedIn and build a following that way, then why spend all that time and effort, right? Mm-hmm. Like if I go to Tech Meme is a news aggregator. If people don't know what it is, it aggregates the biggest stories in tech happening at any time, and takes a bunch of signals of coverage per story, and then it kind of, you know, you can see a leaderboard. But if I scan this, OpenAI is the number one story, expanding internationally. Meta is launching, you know, WhatsApp. Version in Europe that's probably around privacy and GDPR. Yeah. And then the next one is Amazon and Anthropic partnership. Next one is about, you know, Germany banning Chinese tech. It's a pretty big story. The next one is Samsung, you know, Samsung, a big shift in their chip strategy. And if you kind of go down here, Oracle, blah, 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 blah. The first kind of pure play, I'm going all the way down. I'm really scanning all the way down. There is a company called CloudX that got, looks like only one hit in Adweek, but it's founded by the same guys who founded Max and MoPub, which were really big in the mobile era. They raised a Series A. So it's the first one I've seen where a company got any kind of coverage for a Series A announcement. And it's actually built like, it's funny because they attach themselves to something bigger. It says CloudX, which uses Anthropic's Claude to automate X, Y, and Z, raised $30 million in a Series A. So $30 million is a large Series A. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this story is connected to Anthropic, right? As far as a theme. So this just kind of shows you what is going to rise above. So, you know, that tactic of newsjacking, sure, but I mean, I think these are playbooks that are available to larger, more mature companies. I think that's kind of mm-hmm. what I'm getting at. And it's not to say there isn't a craft to it. It's just there's very few people left covering news. I mean, that's all there is to it, and they're covering the biggest news. Mm-hmm. And all of it lately has been around, you know, AI-based tech.
Right.
In the majority.
Right. And the massive players. I mean, you know, it's always just crazy, crazy, insane, like, you know, $50 billion valuations and everything. And,
yeah.
You know,
well, I'm you're sure getting pressure this, to yeah.
put that up.
This is what I mean by a beat reporter being assigned, right? Like if you talk, if you get to know a reporter, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I cover Meta. I cover Microsoft. I cover, you know, I cover this sector, you know, and so they'll cover the largest companies. And so Apple and Google and Meta and Amazon and Microsoft and Oracle to an extent, I mean, Salesforce, they're getting covered anyway, right? Because they're newsmakers at mm-hmm. their scale. So OpenAI obviously is one of those now. So, and Anthropic, and there's a great, you know, and that's a good tension story too, like Anthropic versus OpenAI or OpenAI, you know, open, like one of the stories now is how Oracle's value is being really, you know, eroded because of, you know, a new a new generation of tech coming out and possibly displacing databases, right? So in the way we worked with them before. So those are the stories that are big. And, you know, again, like if you're thinking about, you have a small team, maybe in your B2B tech, maybe it's better to, you know, have content that's relevant to your audience, but then be pushing out as much as you can on social media and then try to be connecting to those folks via LinkedIn or something, right? Or,
yeah.
or do retargeting ads against them, right? Like that's probably a better use of time and resources, is my sense. I know a small agency, a couple of really smart people, and the person, one of the partners there was saying that they have so many friends in PR that are not, that can't find work now. Like as a profession, it's been decimated.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my understanding as well. So I guess this whole episode about how to do PR in the current environment is maybe not to do so much PR.
Well, I think if you look at, if you take a step back, look, again, PR is very effective. It's just a great way to reach a broader audience and get credibility. You know, if you're getting covered, there is a certain amount of credibility and there's a bunch of benefits, but the point is it's much harder to get. So if you look at it just from an ROI standpoint, like putting people's time and effort against it, spending part of your budget on a real agency, because I think that's what it's going to take now. Real agency doesn't just pitch, you know, real agency helps you develop story. But also one thing I'll say is, you know, you have to help them help you. This is something if I'm really thinking about PR, I think it's really critical. Like we talked about data stories, like you as the client, as the company, you have to be the one developing data stories and helping, you know, the PR team stay on top of trends with you. Like you're working with them as a partner and they are kind of a last link in the chain. And if you're not developing things with them and putting a lot of effort into it yourself, you're not going to get much out of the agency either. So you have to also allocate your own time, even if you, and usually head of marketing is relatively involved because also so are execs, especially the CEO, right? Especially if you're a medium to smaller company, like PR, I've been a handler for CEOs like several times, you know, like I am the contact person with the media and you know, that's what you do. And so the agency could be helping you. I've done it with and without. And, you know, long story short is that's very time consuming too. So if you're just thinking about marketing, allocating like on a pie chart, some wedge toward, I don't know, content versus social versus paid media versus events versus whatever versus PR versus SEO, or maybe that's part of content. Like you might not do PR. That's what I'm getting at. But if you can have it in the mix, it still can be effective. I just think it's not available for most anymore. And the bar is very, very high.
Yeah. So what about measurement? Boy, the stories I can tell you about trying to justify PR via metrics that, you know, the CEO and
you get
referrals the team just don't want to take seriously.
It's hard. Like, I think it's like the quality, it's like the number of mentions in articles, where it's placed. Is it a full article about you? Is it partial? Where are you? Are you high up, middle, bottom? The quality of the mention, you know, those are all factors. And then, you know, you can look at referral traffic if there's backlinks. If it's print, you know, and yes, print still exists. Print's super powerful. Print also, by the way, just for anyone who has been in the game, print is more valuable than online. It's perceived as more valuable, but it's impossible to measure. You know, if you get A1 or B1 on those are the sections. A1 would be top of the above the fold print, New York Times bang. I've been B1 with a profile of a company, which is unusually hard to get. And you know, like we did not. Yeah, how do you measure it? You know, like that's the thing. Salespeople can send it out to clients. You can put it in content. You know, you can try to repurpose it, but. I don't know. It's just a very, this is the other problem with earned media is that the measurement of it from a demand generation standpoint is harder. and it does get scrutinized a lot and put in the brand bucket, which is less measurable. So now you're talking about like, also, well, you're talking about like, again, the perception that it helps build, which then is somewhat subjective. And then the thing I was going to add is I can't tell you how many times when I was getting unusual amounts of press, like all the time. At one company, we were pumping out data stories that were super relevant and were just unnatural, like thousands and thousands of press hits over my several year tenure, like unreal and big outlets. Number one on Tech Meme several times. Number one, best, biggest story in the world. Someone, oh, I didn't like the way they said that. Can you go back to the reporter and have them edit it? And it's like, what are you fucking talking about? Like, go back to the reporter and have them edit their coverage, you know, it's like very, it's like hard enough to, so like if it's a big mistake, then yes. And publicists do that. And again, it's a relationship game.
Factual mistakes, but not.
Yeah. You make a request and you just kind of, and so that's the other thing too, is that it's an influence game. You don't tell the press what to do.
Yeah.
You attempt to influence them and be on their radar and be considered newsworthy in a way they'll cover. And then there's this, you know, even in a high volume game, it's very hard to go back. And I mean, that relationship is, you know, what have you done for me lately relationship. And yeah. So I don't know. It's a very interesting thing. The measurement of it and then people's like, I don't know, perception that they should be able to just make reporters write what you want them to. It's like, I can't imagine something, by the way, more insulting to a reporter, than like, oh yeah, my CEO would like you to reword this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I just remember doing press events where we would usually around very huge product launches. And I remember this one massive one. I've never again done a press event this big for a huge consumer product launch. It was when I was in the video game industry, major brand among a certain hardcore audience of gamers. It wasn't, I mean, I've done broad Hollywood properties. I managed Star Trek for many years, this video game company I was at, and, you know, down at Paramount every month at the time, you know, managing that relationship. And, you know, those were big. This was just like a hardcore gamer brand that was huge. And we felt that we needed to like put on a big production to appeal to this hardcore audience. And we rented out an auditorium. We had staged these different actors to play these parts that were within the game. And just, you know, did this whole big thing. And I remember sitting in the office with our head of PR and the CEO trying to convince him that, you know, this was worth the money. I don't think that would ever happen anymore these days, specifically around one brand. And now it's also televised, so to speak, streamed over the internet, you know, just very large, central product launches. But to do that for one product within a portfolio of many large brands, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't happen anymore. But, you know, you needed the press back then to get back to our.
Well, the press was a bigger. Point. Yeah, the press was a more viable channel for reach. There was a time where doing television advertising was a great spend if you could afford it because you could reach a massive audience.
Yeah.
That probably ended around 2000-ish or so. It's like really started eroding because the internet came along and fragmentation and social media came along. And, you know, like if you look at the share of you know, all television, in fact, the measurement of TV reach is totally changed because Netflix doesn't publish those numbers, right? So, but, you know, you used to reach, I don't know, 60 million households or something crazy, like potentially, and 30 million, whatever. And now the big shows, if there is a big show in episodic TV that's, say, on a network still, I mean, that's smaller and smaller and smaller. It's like very, very small. Like if you're getting 1 million, 2 million, that's like a decent audience.
Right, so, yeah.
That's so, you know, same thing with press. Yeah. Press, And the reason I kind of bring all that up is press is similar. Like press used to be lots of outlets, lots of reach. And, you know, print, when the internet came along, newspapers and magazines started dying, and they used to be a big deal. I'm telling you, and not that long ago, 15, 20 years ago, getting a really nice piece and a really reputable a Newsweek or a Businessweek or a Bloomberg meant a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So you can look back at times like you were with major IP like Star Trek, and you had a major announcement of a game, of, you know, IP tie-in, and you were had a scheduled event where you knew there would be reporters coming. At Electronic Arts, we used to have a press day. I can't remember what it was called. We would have the press come, and we'd be showing off all of our titles we were building, you know, and give you know, sneak previews to the press. But there were a lot of press covering games back then, and they would come. So we'd have a major event, and it would be all of our IP, right? And so it was a great relationship building. It was great to get on the radar with your titles, you know, to show them stuff about the game, to start getting early coverage, to start getting them to know about your upcoming product launch. Because, you know, these were significant investments. You know, we were spending millions of dollars building games. And so this is,
right.
this is a,
yeah.
My point is, it's a totally different scale at a different time. And so I can see all that. Like, that was just a different era, I guess. You know, now things are, you know, we're in a content creator age. Mm-hmm. And social media, I remember social media manager 10 years ago, I was like, is that even a job? You know, but now it's just like, it's a channel where you have real interaction with an audience.
Yeah.
You have to think about,
well, and I even wonder, I mean, we haven't even gotten into influencers and influencer marketing, because that's kind of taking up a lot of the oxygen as well. I mean, they are basically a publication, right? They're a brand that has an audience. And, you know, Anthropic has been doing this. I've been seeing these ads on, I think, Facebook and LinkedIn, where they have this influencer and it says Claude and the influencer name, right? I have no idea who these people are, but I'm sure they've got big audiences. And the video is just that influencer and how they use Claude, right? And it's 10 to 15 seconds. And essentially, you know, now, I guess it's not really PR, because you're not, you know, they're being paid, right? They're being paid to be featured in that content.
Yeah, it's a little more of a, right, because PR, you know, before even blogging, when it was journalism, real journalism is supposed to be neutral and objective and unbiased. Mm-hmm. And even though I know outlets lean left or right or whatever, but that's the theory. That's sort of the purest principle. And to have an article, you used to have like three different sources. You know, you'd have to go out and interview different people and get multiple points of view. And, you know, that would create a trustworthy kind of 360, you know, degree.
Gets back to trust. Yeah.
Right. And so then blogging came along, was very fast cycle, and it was about being first, and the fact checking started getting looser. And now, you know, what you're talking about is not even, to your point, it's not journalism. It's a person who reaches an audience. I mean, if we want to decompose it to that, they reach an audience. They have some measure of credibility, probably more under the evangelist bucket, but influencer / evangelist or ambassador, you know, is a term. And yes, there is a financial relationship, or there's some compensation there between the company and the influencer who is touting said. I mean, these are just
you're getting back to the key thing about authenticity.
These are publishers.
And trust.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, and, you know, the thing traditionally about, you know, a TechCrunch or a VentureBeat is that I can trust these guys when they're reporting on XYZ company and what they do. I want to listen to them, right? And they're bringing along that validation so that the readers know that when they're reading about XYZ product or XYZ company, they're getting the real story. Like you said, you know, it's the whole trust factor. And I don't know if I said this, you said this on our last episode and it's really stuck with me. Did I mention this earlier? Trust got a lot more expensive, or trust has gotten a lot more expensive.
Yeah, Bill, earning trust is much more expensive now.
Yeah, because of all the noise. And, you know, I guess maybe PR, that's what they do. You know, if I'm being cynical,
it's maybe it was more of a quote unquote gentleman's agreement before. You know, the media company, let's take the New York Times, they are a business and they have cost and they have revenue and they staff reporters, which costs salary. And they have an operating model, you know, they got to operate the website, blah, 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 monetization team, figuring out subscriptions, there's all this stuff going on. And so they're the content creator, the editorial team is the content creators for the media publishing operation. And they're supposed to remain objective to a degree because they have to attract an audience that trusts them and will come back, right? So mm-hmm. there's this trust thing. And there used to be a barrier, or we used to talk about whether this is PC or not to say, we call it a Chinese wall. There's a Chinese wall between
right.
you know, the great editorial, wall of China, but there's a big barrier between, reporting and sales. And so you used to, you knew there was still some influence. If you're a big advertiser, whatever. So my point is there's always been an exchange, if you will, of value and wealth and whatever. Maybe now it's a little more pointed because it's like, hey, I go find an influencer that has 200,000 or a million, followers, mm-hmm. and they have reach, and maybe they reach the audience I want. At the end of the day, like the game we're playing, and the reason I even talked about newsworthiness is like when you go market for a company, your job is to help them sell the product, and you want to build awareness and interest, and you go through the model and buyer's journey and all that shit. But at the end of the day, you're a commercial entity and you are trying to drive awareness and ultimately sales or revenue for your company. So you are commercially oriented. You're trying to right size your stories and your influence into what would be acceptable for a press person who is, thinking about their audience, but at the same time works for a company, mm-hmm. right? That is also a business that is all. So it's sort of a weird, the separation between what is credible and objective versus commercial has just gotten narrower,
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always been there as my point, and we always went through contortions to try to be newsworthy and objective. But the truth is we're trying to sell stuff. They're trying to sell stuff. And right. there is a cynical part of all this. I think there's a way to do it well where all parties get satisfied, most notably the audience that you're trying to serve as a reporter. And there are great reporters out there who are highly principled.
Yeah.
And I've met them. I mean, some of them are – I mean, some of these people – some reporters I've met are easily some of the smartest people on the planet. They just the speed at which they understand things that are happening and get it explained to them and synthesize it is unreal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then their ability to communicate that, turn around really fast writing cycles, and this is I'm talking pre-ChatGPT clearly, where they could actually write something very fast. So and credible. And so that is kind of a dying breed, You see it also. The other thing too, I'll say one more thing about PR and the fragmentation of it is not just the influencer social media. It is also podcasts, right? We're a podcast. Like I listen to some of my political news. I know you do too on podcasts now. Mm-hmm. So it's still the quote unquote reporter or the pundit. They're just in a talk show format, right? So again, it's dissemination of information. Yeah.
But it's more direct and unedited. And I think if you're looking for the themes in this conversation, which we've been going all over the place because obviously we're both feeling a a shift in the way the world works. It's authenticity and trust.
Yep.
Right? And, you know, is PR and these, you know, the publications, whether they're online or they're podcasts or whatever, you know, how do you get through to your desired audiences, your authenticity, build that trust to get them to, at the end of the day, listen to your pitch and hopefully part with their money? Peter, I think that may be a good place to wrap up. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. At the end of the day, you're trying to reach an audience with some measure of credibility. And yep. you can do it directly, indirectly, through intermediary layers like PR, podcast, social. And I think the challenge for the marketer today is, as we think specifically about PR, is does that have a home in your marketing mix and to what extent?
Yep. All right. Do you want to read us out?
We want to thank you, our audience, for listening. Our editors, Lorenzo Fernandez-Kopek at Peepout Studios and Brian Douglas at the Creative Commonwealth, for making us sound and look great. Our marketing maven, Ian Robinson-Lambert, for getting the word out. Julianne Bornales for being our consulting producer. Renita Dutta for driving our marketing research and content calendar. And of course, Thomas Moyer, president of the AMA San Francisco, for presenting this podcast.